Hello and welcome to Meet the Influectuals.
They're influential, they're intellectuals. Yep, you've got it. They are the Influectuals.
This is a podcast about research communications.
I'm John Schwartz, I'm the CEO of Soapbox. We're a design agency working with a lot of the world's leading think tanks, academic institutions and NGOs.
And I'm Sonia Chalfin, Director of Sociopublico, a strategy and communication studio for complex ideas.
And we're on a mission to find out the best ways to communicate knowledge, ideas and evidence.
So each episode, we are meeting a leading influential who can help us on that mission.
Today, Sonia and I are in London. We're attending the On Think Tanks conference, which is being held at Chatham House, the Royal Institute of International Affairs. And it's a great conference because it's a group of people with diverse opinions, sometimes conflicting opinions, but bound together by the desire, the passion to drive forward evidence-informed policy. And there's a bond of trust, I think, between the people here, and that's why I'm enjoying it so much. And that trust, I guess, that's something that can seem lacking in so many political and policy processes these days. And if we can't talk to each other with trust, well, then we can't move forward, can we? At this conference, Sonia and I have been spotting influentials everywhere we look, but one of them has really stood out, because maybe, just maybe, she knows the answer to how we can build policy processes with trust and progress at their heart. Chiara Rosselli is the co-founder and executive director of Apropos. They are a collective of process designers, facilitators, and political analysts working for better communication in and collaboration in politics and policy. Chiara, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, John. I'm very happy to be here.
So do you want to just start off by telling us a little bit about Apropos? Why did you start the organization? What's the problem that you're solving?
Yeah, so Apropos is actually born out of a different experience, which is the experience of the Open European Dialogue. And we started the Open European Dialogue around 2015, essentially at a time where political discourse in Europe was going more or less like this. You know, the Greeks were, actually the Germans were asking the Greeks to sell their islands to pay off for their debt. And the Greeks were answering, why don't you instead give me back my World War II reparation money?
Right. And so, you thought there's a job to be done here.
And we thought, that sounds great. That sounds exactly where we need to be right now in Europe to fix the problems we have. So that's the context within which we started this idea, this project that became a dialogue platform for European politicians across borders, across party lines. And the intuition was really to try and create a space where people could meet face to face and get to know each other instead of just hearing of each other through the media, through, you mm-hmm. know, hearsay, mm-hmm. essentially. Shall I continue about how that evolved into Apropos?
Absolutely, go ahead.
Because yeah, just being together is not enough, right? You need to build the process or something else to build the trust and to actually have the conversations going.
Exactly. I think that's a common misconception is, you know, we say just being together breeds trust. I think that's true in some cases, and that's true when people don't have a specific reason not to like each other, but it's not true in all cases. And I think we've seen that also backfire often, you know, saying let's just bring everyone together, be a sort of happy family, and that will fix all of our trust issues. Mm-hmm. No, what we realize is we have to design for trust building in these exchanges. So essentially, after 8+ years of doing this experiment that turned out to be Europe's first dialogue platform for politicians, we understood that there was a methodology behind it that mm-hmm. we were using that we wanted to start sort of exporting to other contexts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that was how Apropos was born. So the idea of bringing process design into the political sphere.
Was this a dialogue just among politicians or also involving think tankers or other people producing knowledge or evidence?
Yes, there's always think tankers. We're a consortium of think tankers with three think tanks in the south of Europe and one in Germany. And so they've always also been involved in these exchanges. Absolutely, yes.
Because what I think it's interesting is we are doing the podcast to talk about communications or evidence-based knowledge being communicated to the political sphere and to the general public.
Yeah.
And but we often tend to think about this, about bringing some information to the policymakers or to the decision makers, and not as is it should be a dialogue between someone with the knowledge and someone who needs to learn about that to implement some policy. So, but also it's so interesting that you're thinking about this as a conversational methodology. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yes, to me it's rather basic as an idea. I mean, we cannot keep producing information and sort of, let's say, forcing other people to consume it. If we are producing information that is supposed to be of use, of service to policymakers, then we should be in conversation with policymakers to understand what it is exactly that they need.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me, yes, otherwise we're operating blindly and then just sort of figuring that last step out at the end.
Seems like something as you would hear in a startup talking about the user experience or
exactly
what the user needs,
yes,
right?
Mm. Yes.
And you talk a lot about process design. And obviously as a designer, as soon as I hear the word design, it was my ears prick up about that. What is process design? How does it differ from other methodologies that people have used to put together dialogues? Why is it better?
Well, what we're trying to do is appropriate this new brand, really, that is about political process design.
Mm-hmm.
And why we've decided to use these words is because often when you use, things like user-centric design, human-centric design thinking, and you try to convince the political sector that there is some use in these methodologies also for our sector, there's a sort of skepticism of saying, yes, but you're just applying something that is not tailored to the political world. And so what we didn't want to use a term that existed and that we just transposed into the political world. Mm. We wanted to create a brand that comes from our own direct experience doing this work. So for me, process design, and in specifically political process design, is the care and thought processes that go into defining how you get from A to B once you've defined what B is in terms of your objective.
Yeah.
And what are the all of the small steps going from how many meetings with how many people, how do you talk to these people, what sort of room or space are you in to have that conversation, what is on the agenda, how long each agenda item is, the shape of the tables, what's on the name tags. So it's everything.
Okay, I'm tired already.
I know, exactly. Yeah. Which is why you need, I think, specific expertise, someone who does that and has done it over and over again with a political audience and with a political policy mindset.
Can you walk us through the process from a communications perspective? Imagine that, I don't know, we are think tankers working on, I don't know, how to reform the pension system on a certain country.
Mm-hmm.
Easy peasy. But we want to bring our ideas to the political system, how we should start and go through the process.
Okay. So a simplified version that we use, or framework, is called the 3 P's framework. And it's the process of aligning people, purpose, and process.
Mm-hmm.
And we think of it as a reiterative cyclical process. So it never ends until the day that you've achieved your, let's say, either event, report, ta-da-da. What we do with that is we usually advise people to start with the purpose. I'm sorry. So you said reforming the pension system.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So we're a group of think tankers reforming the pension system. We would first ask people to ask themselves some critical questions. Okay, in what way, to what extent, within what time frame, and then start to have a reality check about what is possible.
Mm-hmm.
That is honestly one of the hardest processes to do. But let's assume that we get to a measurable purpose, something that will work. Actually, we don't want to reform the pension system. We want to be able to provide two new ideas that are genuinely new to this specific ministry and 15 other policy influencers.
Okay, so far we haven't involved the politicians or the decision makers. So we are just thinking with the researchers to define our strategy and our goals. Is that right?
So far, okay. What you've done, is just identify what policymakers you want to influence, which is often not done. You know, we jump to, we're going to create the report and then we'll just peddle it through our usual channels and
great
contacts.
Great point, yes.
Or we treat policymakers as if they were a, you know, one homogenous group of people, which is always wrong.
Exactly, that's true. That's true. So let's say we've done that. Okay, so ideally, it depends also how much you want to invest in these processes. So that's also the reality check. Mm-hmm. I think we need to know this. You can't do this to this extent for everything. But where it matters, you know, you invest more time into it. Let's assume then that you have some contacts already in those ministries. You would talk to them first to figure out, okay, this is what I'm thinking. These are the directions we're going. Is this useful? Not. The more of them you talk to, the more you can get feedback. On the basis of that, you can then build a process that aligns with what you need to do. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, I don't want to go into the details because it can get a bit nitty-gritty and boring. But it's really about a mental framework of always keeping your objective and the people that you need to reach that objective in mind when designing a process.
And the details are so important, aren't they? You sort of mentioned the details before and you kind of get into details. And it reminds me of a story I heard just a couple of days ago. A friend of mine who's an actor was in a play about the Good Friday Agreement in the Lyric Theatre in Belfast, and he was telling me a story about when they wanted to do the Good Friday Agreement, the peace agreement in Northern Ireland. One side wanted a table where they were sitting next to each other, so a round table. The other side wanted a table where they were sitting opposite each other, and they couldn't agree. And this was a massive sticking point in order to even start these negotiations. They ended up with a diamond-shaped table so they could sit next to each other and opposite each other simultaneously. And I think it's that kind of thinking about those kind of details that makes a huge difference in the design process. What is it always different when you do that?
There are some we specialize in trust building dialogues, right? So a lot of what we do is really around creating spaces for empathy to arise, for getting to know the political other outside of labeling, interacting with the other outside of already very polarized topics so that you can find common ground on maybe other areas. And so because of that, you know, certain things remain similar. You know, you don't want people to step into the room with already made up preconceptions of who's going to be there. So, for example, a pretty unconventional thing that we do with our policymakers is we refuse to give them the list of participants beforehand. Because we all know what's going to happen in that case. They're going to look through it, identify the seven people who they think are interesting, who think like them, and go speak to them and judge everybody else who's coming.
So it's like a blind date, in a sense.
A little bit, yeah.
And how do you find those bridges? How do you find those? Because we do know, I think, and there's a lot of evidence on how once we discover that we have something in common with another person, then we can start building a real dialogue and building trust. But sometimes it's not that easy to find that that thing in common. And there's always something, but it's not that easy to find it.
I think a big element is keeping agendas that can be open to a certain extent. So allowing issues that are important to your audience, so in this case, policymakers, to emerge by themselves. And if you have an agenda that's packed and you're telling people what exactly they have to talk about all the time, there'll be no way for them to wander into these areas where, oh, actually, I had no idea that like a socialist from Cyprus might agree with me on this specific urbanization issue that is not part of the agenda. So it's really creating the space for these things to emerge.
Yeah, sometimes we think that it's important to have a lot of focus on your agenda, on your topic, but what you're saying, it's just the opposite. Let's leave it very open so that we can find coincidences that might be outside of the main topic, but that will help us anyway because they are helping us build trust. So that's rather counterintuitive.
It is counterintuitive. I also think that this is about doing things differently and designing things differently on purpose because what we've done hasn't worked, right? In certain contexts, You know, we're not saying let's change completely the way we have all political dialogue conversations, but clearly the systems that we have, the structures that we have right now, nudge people into negotiation, into aggression, mm-hmm. into toxic sort of wanting to win the argument. And what we're trying to say, is there a different kind of conversation that we can nudge mm-hmm. people to have? And we can't do that unless we're changing a little bit our usual way of operating.
Yeah. You wrote a paper which came out in February of this mm-hmm. of this year, which is available on your website, which the URL is, tell the listeners.
Aproposgroup.org.
Aproposgroup.org.
That's and, apropos with an S.
And you said that, just expanding a bit on what you've just started talking about, you've got a whole kind of paper on this, and you say that the political system is failing because the processes that regulate it are no longer fit for purpose. What are those weaknesses that you identified in that paper of the current political system?
Yeah, so one of the main ones, so there's a couple. I think the two I'll focus on is one, let's think about it this way. So many of our societal sectors have evolved in a way that the political sector has not. You know, the R&D mm-hmm. unit of politics is lacking. Yeah. We're not stepping up sort of in terms of methodologies, in terms of adapting to the way that the society has changed. That's why I think it's an element that personally I find very, very compelling when we talk about trust, to remember it's not just about the political system. This is about us having growing distrust also with our neighbors, the mm-hmm. fact that we only interact through screens. All of this is creating a completely different societal context that the political infrastructures unfortunately have to adapt to, right? And so the lack of adaptability and like potential for self-renewal of these systems that are, you know, in constitutions, they're in laws, they're not easy to change, is a problem. Is a problem because how do we keep a flexible, agile political sector if, you know, these rules of the game of engagement with citizens are so strict? Which is why I think informal spaces can really help. And the other bullet point I would say is just a reiteration of what I've already mentioned. The idea is the theme of the conference today is uncertainty, no? Think tanks in political uncertainty. We are, I think people have said it, that are smarter than myself, we're in a moment where uncertainty is all we can count on. And it's been like this for a while. In situations where we are completely uncertain, we cannot keep doing the same thing and expect a different result. Mm-hmm. We need to create design, spaces for different kinds of thinking, to overcome groupthink, to make unpopular opinions emerge. But that doesn't just happen. It does not just happen. What just happens is that by design, we tend to conform, which is mm-hmm. normal. It is rational because that's the way all rational actors would react in such a system.
I guess the thing that I'm sort of... I'm buying into what you're saying, but I guess the thing that worries me is scale, because you've talked about, you know, how we're, you know, mistrust is building not just in the political sphere but across society in general, and you've offered us some solutions as to how we can build trust, you know, through the Open European Dialogue and other such mechanisms, but those feel to me like, you know, places where we're getting groups of people together. Smaller groups of people together. Is there a way to kind of scale up what you're doing?
Yes. I think the scale-up solution is the following. We need to understand and build our own capacity as operators in the sector, as think tankers, as people in ministries, tarara, to design in a way that is purpose-driven mm-hmm. the things that we do. Mm-hmm. And I think this is rooted in our understanding of the role of emotions, the role of irrationality, you know?
Yeah.
Like, a lot of what we do comes from an understanding of political decision-making that is rooted in cognitive and behavioral sciences, i.e. we think we're rational, we're not. And we have to build systems that consciously can work in these irrationalities to some degree. But I'll give you a concrete example, because this is a methodology and I believe in it can be applied everywhere, but we need to train ourselves. Mm-hmm. The same way we train ourselves to be better communicators, mm-hmm. we need to train ourselves to be better process designers mm-hmm. for all of the spaces where important decisions are being made. So there's an institutional format, it's called COSAC, which is a horrible acronym that I cannot repeat, it's French, but it happens twice a year and it's the dialogue exchange, the moment of exchange between national parliaments at the European level. Mm-hmm. So it happens twice a year and the function of it is to create better debate and exchange across parliaments. The format of it that is being used is a succession of 2-minute speeches that happen one after the other with sort of final Q&A at the end of each session, 30-minute coffee breaks. This happens reiteratively for 2 days and then everyone goes home. Mm. There is no dialogue happening in this dialogue space. Mm-hmm. The dialogue is happening in the coffee breaks if you're lucky.
Yeah.
There are better ways that we can design these spaces so that they can achieve what they want to achieve.
Mm. It's interesting that you mention cognitive psychology because we do know, I think most people is aware because there's been such a great development of this discipline in the last years that we have to take into account that we are not rational. Everyone has read Kahneman and we know about this. But But sometimes I find that working on communications, that people tend to confuse this. Like, we are not rational, so we are emotional. And mm-hmm. it seems that when we talk about this, we are referring to telling stories and being emotional or connecting with our feelings. And of course, that's generally useful to communicate, but there's much more there. Like, you've been talking about behavior, building trust, understanding if the other is, we tend to be all the time monitoring if the rest of the people is a threat or mm-hmm. someone who's going mm-hmm. to cooperate with us. And those are not just feelings. It's something different. So I think sometimes we lack the right vocabulary to talk about this. Can you explain a little bit more? How are you bringing the insights from cognitive or behavioral sciences into your work?
Yeah, no, I think you're really right. And to be honest, I don't see myself as an academic on these things, and I do believe that we don't have a common language, and we tend to go from, we're either emotional, mm-hmm. which we equate to...
Yeah, make me cry with a nice story.
Or to stupid, ecco. Yeah. We equate it to stupid, let's be honest. Mm-hmm. We're like, emotional, so wrong, mm-hmm. or rational, right. And if everyone just was rational, we'd have the best
policy. Yes, like we need to have this like superficial emotional thing, because that's a pity. We should be discussing the real thing, but there is so much in between, right?
Yeah, and emotions often are a vehicle also to truth, right? Mm-hmm. What you're saying is, for example, this idea of having to constantly evaluate, am I safe, am I not? What am I mm-hmm. going to share? What am I not going to share? So yesterday we were speaking at the conference with a colleague about ideas for example, bursting the think tank bubble. And we were just throwing around some thoughts, and she asked, you know, what I thought about the fact that the conference today is closed doors. You know, why don't we have the public in so that they can, you know, we can connect to what they think. And I asked her, okay, yes, but to what purpose would we be bringing in the public, right? And I sort of prompted her, and she said, you know, to make sure that we can be a bit more critical also in our thinking, to challenge us. And I said, yes, but how would you feel if, you know, you open up the doors and you know that the purpose of these people being brought into the conversation is just to challenge you? How are you going to react? Because personally, what I would do is I would clam up, you know, I would stick to my bullet points that I've written down. I would be so nervous that I wouldn't be able to listen to what they're saying. And what could become a positive critical incentive to reflect on my work would just become a sort of something that I need to fight off, especially because, hey, it's happening in public now in front of all of my peers. So these are very silly things, but they are small and important. How you do something affects immensely whether it works or not, regardless of your intention. So in that case, you know, what I would advocate is, no, we don't do it that way. It's important also for the think tanks to have a safe space where we can talk. But if we want to open the door to citizens, we can create an engaged format where their unique role is not just to challenge us, but again, where we can design a dialogue that is two-way among equals.
I'm really fascinated by this idea that you are interested in the how of policies. Most of the think tanks that we work with are interested in what are the policy solutions, yes. What are the recommendations going to be. You're the only one that I've kind of come across that's interested in how do we do politics, how do we do policy. You know, why is the how so important?
John, I feel like that's a trick question. What do you mean? How is it not? No, I mean, thanks for picking up on that. That's something that we're very passionate about at Apropos. And I think, I mean, the answer to the question, why is it so important? I can only say because it doesn't work otherwise.
Yeah. Another way of putting it would be, why do we need a think tank for how?
Oh, okay, perfect. Because we are all busy and we all have our own areas of expertise, and it's understandable that certain things just fall through the cracks.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And I'm sure you have been through this with communications. Mm-hmm. No, suddenly now, you know, there's a way bigger understanding of the important strategic role of communications in think tanks. But for a long time, it was just, hey, call the comms guy at the end, have them package this in a cute way. Yeah. And then
put some varnish on the door we have already built.
Exactly. And that's understandable for a researcher, for someone whose main role is to produce research, because that's where they're investing most of the time.
Yeah.
So you have to forcefully put yourself into their work.
Yeah.
And that's why we want to be a think tank that promotes this, not only to raise awareness, hey, we need to develop this skill set. It is a strategic asset that think tanks can no longer do without. But we also want to be there to do capacity building for others, to really put this on their agenda, if that makes sense.
It makes total sense. That's an absolutely fantastic answer.
Are there any particular lessons for communicators that you have run into going through these processes? Like, for instance, while you are into one of these dialogues and you want to present information to participants, is there a way that works better than others to give them data, for instance, or evidence on a certain on the topic they are discussing about?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm gonna wing it because I would say it's, you know, I think there's people who have smarter things to say about this than I might. I think what I can share is how we tend to do it and how we brief our experts to do it. Because, again, the objective for us is to open up a space for conversation among people who think differently. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, but you said something before that I think you know more than you think. You said something that it's really counterintuitive. You said you don't give all the information before the. So one way to look at it, like the traditional way, would be, let's be transparent. Let's provide people with all the information that is there that they need to go into the dialogue. And you were saying before, we found that it's better not to tell them exactly who they are going to be meeting during the process. So I guess there are other, probably there are insights.
Probably are, yes. Now you make me think of the, what we call the, I don't remember where I got this from, but there's some research about the effective tipping point. You know, when do people start considering information in the optic of potentially changing their mind, right? Mm-hmm. So not just to confirm what they've heard. Mm-hmm. And apparently it's when they're a little bit stressed. So it's a little bit of, I don't know.
You have to pay attention when... there's this, sorry, I interrupt you
on
this,
please.
But there's this very interesting finding of people testing... of people to remember something they have read, and they in this experiment they have provided people with a text with a quite a big font and some other people with a very, very small font. And mm-hmm. they found that the people who had to make the effort to read the very small font, they remembered more. So, and that's really counterintuitive again for us communicators, that you think you have to put these big signs with great, wonderful fonts for people to notice you. But of course, you first need to grab the attention of someone if you want them to read the small fonts. But after you have done that, maybe you need to make it more difficult, not easier for them to grab the information. And that might be the tipping point.
And it depends if you're communicating to add information to a point, to a position they already have, right? That's one direction. Or if you're trying to communicate to have someone question whether they really know where they stand on a topic, right? So to start beginning opening up the possibility of changing your mind. And in that instance, you need to put people in a position to say, maybe I don't know. Maybe I'm not so sure. And so I think that's something we always try and ask our experts to do, is there anything that you can, any hook, any angle? We know you have 157,000 beautiful things to say, but is there one that's unexpected, or that's a completely different framing or intuition, like you said? And just use that, because what that will do is it'll get people to open up their minds and actually listen.
Kiara, thanks so much for joining us. I could talk to you all day, and probably will spend the rest of the day talking to you, but our time has run out. One of the things that we're doing at the end of each episode of this podcast is we're giving people a little room to think. We want to give our listeners room to think about what they've heard with 2 minutes of ambient sound, and we're asking our guest to choose what would you like our listeners to listen to while they're thinking about what you've told us today.
Okay, so I would go with silence.
Okay, fantastic. So we're going to leave you all with 2 minutes of silence. Sonia and I are going to go and shut ourselves away and record absolute silence while we meditate and think about what Kiara has told us. Kiara, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks,
everyone.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Meet the Influectuals with me, John Schwartz, and my co-host, Sonia Jalfin. Production was by Lara Sheshatti-Praise. Post-production was by Dario Jalfin. This podcast is produced by Soapbox and Socio Publico, two design and communications agencies working at the intersection of research and social progress. You can learn more about us at designbysoapbox.com and sociopublico.com. And feel free to contact us with ideas for future episodes. Just use the email addresses you'll find on our website. Thanks for listening.